Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. Win. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
So, Web is Jericho had an article on the new Randy Savage book by John Finkel, and BJ Lisko, who did the interview with you. John was able to hook us up.
Yes.
First of all, man, congrats on this book. I haven't had a chance to read it because it's not out yet, but I was and still am a huge Randy Savage fan. I'm assuming you are as well. How did you decide to write this book about this guy who's been gone for almost 10 years now at this point?
Yeah, I grew up, Randy was my guy, right? So I grew up watching WWF back then as early as possible. I was like, so I was a big John Studd fan. So when I was little, I used to call myself Little John Studd. That's how deep I was into it. We got to meet him at a store signing, you know, that the guys used to do all the time. And it, like,
where'd you grow up?
So I grew up in Massachusetts.
So, gotcha. So that's prime WWE area.
Yes. We saw him at a Toys R Us signing that my dad worked for at the time. And it was like the coolest thing ever. And I brought my Hulk Hogan and my Macho Man toys, and he was wrestling with them and all that. And then, you know, I was 8 at WrestleMania 3. All in on every possible thing wrestling, believing everything, believing Ricky Steamboat's larynx was crushed, believing that Macho Man actually was treating Elizabeth terribly, you know, believing that when whoever lost, you know, Warrior versus Savage, they were actually going to retire from wrestling forever. Like, I was at the age where it was all possible and believable. So I came of age in wrestling where Randy became my guy back in the prime of like when Macho was at his absolute apex. And so I lived Saturday Night Main Event to Sunday Morning Cartoon, right? I had the Wrestle Buddies, I had the dolls, and everything I wanted to do wrestling wise. You know, when you look at the moves, I had a younger brother, you know, doing the elbow drop. It's like the easiest move to do off your bed to your younger brother, right? So like, I wanted to do that. That was way cooler than just like Hogan's leg drop on the carpet or something. So just that, his style standing out. So for me, you know, obviously Hogan was like the Jordan back then. But Macho was my guy when I became an author, wanted to write. That was like my Mount Everest biography. I'd always held out there, and I'm pumped that I got to do it.
So I'm assuming this is not the first book you've written then, if it's your Mount Everest. Have you had other titles that you've done?
Yeah, this is the 10th book that I've written. So this was like, I'd had this in my pocket for a while. Amazingly, no one had done the definitive Randy Savage biography, so I'm glad that was still there.
Right.
I'd done books on Mean Joe Green's autobiography. I did Charlie Ward's biography. The Heisman Trophy winner, played for the Knicks in the NBA Finals. And then the book before this was on 1996, a book on the Seattle Supersonics I did. So a lot of books with a lot of athletes and a lot of different topics from a nostalgia standpoint. But Macho was my white whale, so to speak. So I'm glad I got to do it.
So how do you do this? Because once again, I mean, obviously Macho Man is so ensconced in WWF, WWE history. Anybody can write about whatever they want. But what kind of did you feel you had to do to write this book when you first started thinking about it?
Yeah, I'm glad this wasn't my first, because I would have probably screwed it up. I learned a lot of lessons along the way of how to research. And my background is in journalism, but for muscle and fitness and men's fitness for a long time. So I'd written cover stories on Batista and Triple H and Brock and a lot of UFC guys for some of the big magazines. So I have a lot of the chops that I felt I needed and the confidence that I needed to write it. But you know, with this kind of thing, it starts with research and interviews, right? It's like, you know, you put a big proposal together. You've written a bunch of books. It's a book proposal of what you're going to write about, what you're going to put in there. Some of your resources are going to be. And then you just spend, you know, a ton of time, and especially with someone like Macho, the newspaper archives all throughout the territories, learning about his father, Angelo. And then you start interviewing, you know, that I've learned is the most incredible part of the process. It's like, I refer to it as like Mike Tyson talks about planning for a fight. Like everyone has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And it's the same thing with a book. You have a plan for the book until you talk to the first person who says, you know, you got to talk to, and then you talk to that person.
Right.
And you know, if you're, it's what you do as an interviewer, you say, so who do I have to talk to? What story do I have to follow up on? And you're 3 days in and 12 interviews in, and none of those people you were supposed to talk to in the beginning. And now you're off and running, just pulling all those threads.
Well, and also too, like when you're writing this book about Randy, Randy's gone. I mean, Elizabeth is obviously gone. Angelo Poffo, not with us anymore. I think his mother's not with us anymore. So who is it that you want to talk to first and foremost to give you like the most cred for this book?
Yeah. So I wanted to do the book in 2019. I finished the proposal. And I pitched it to a bunch of publishers, and obviously people were interested. Macho Man is a super popular nostalgic figure even to this day. The memes on Twitter and Instagram have kind of moved him into a new category. Slim Jim is now back with a lot of the commercials and things.
Right.
To me, the only person I had to talk to, and I knew I was going to talk to hundreds of people, but I was not going to do this book unless I got to talk to Lanny.
Gotcha. Well, okay. Yeah.
There was just no way I could not have access to him. And I was prepared to honestly not do the book. And that was why it got held up for about a year and a half. I am close to my brother. I understand wrestling in the family that he came from at the time. You know, nobody knew Lanny was going to pass away, but I would have kind of felt like a fraud if I went on and interviewed, you know, I think I got over well over 200 people or something for this book. And if somehow I didn't talk to Lanny, that would have been the first question you or anyone I would have asked if I was interviewing me is like, did you talk to Lanny? Especially if he was still alive. And so it took about a year to get in touch with him. He lived half the year in Ecuador. I don't know if your paths ever crossed, but, he was a bit of an eccentric guy. I mean,
absolutely.
I loved talking to him, but he was not always around. He wasn't always on social. We ended up getting in touch over like, I don't know, some off-brand Telegram, Facebook messaging thing that he wanted to use.
MySpace.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, we were back in MySpace era talking. So, but we did get in touch. The first thing he asked me right off the bat was if I was related to Howard Finkel, which I'm not. But I said, my dad's Harvey Finkel, so they have the same initials, so hopefully that counts for something.
What an icebreaker.
Yeah, and he appreciated that. If you know him, he loved wordplay and coincidences and clever things.
Yeah.
And so he's like, all right, you know, son of an HF. Well, what do you want to talk about? Son of an HF or whatever he called
it. It's funny just to jump in about Lanny. So I had Lanny on Talk as Jericho years ago, obviously, and it was the same thing. He was very, even though I was in the business for years, he was very careful about what he said about his family, about his brother, about his dad, about his mom. You could tell that they had a pretty close or at least a tight-knit relationship where he's not going to come and talk trash about anything.
Right.
He's very respectful of his memories.
Yeah. And this is on the heels of a couple of the documentaries that came out that really focused on not the most – either forget flattery
on the bad stuff, right?
They were trying to clickbait. They were clickbait documentaries, I would say. And so he wanted to make sure I wouldn't. So I sent him, you know, my roster of the books and the articles, and that I'm a journalism writer and, you know, author first. I'm not coming at this to like get a hook. I want to tell the full story, mainly of the Poffos, and then how that shaped Randy and how Randy became Macho Man. And so I was loaded with questions. So my pitch was like, look, I'm going to cover everything. I'm going to interview all his high school teammates and his minor league baseball teammates and other wrestlers and people who are on the set of Spider-Man. Like, I'm going to do all that work.
Right.
But what I would love to talk to you about is the small stuff. Like, what was it like in your apartment in Toledo for 6 months when you guys were there? And what was the car rides like to the arenas when you were 12 and Randy was 14? Or what was it like to walk in to an arena where your dad was getting booed because he was good at his job, but you were like six and didn't understand? And that was the stuff that he got. He's like, okay, so you want to know what it was like. You want to tell his life story. You don't just want to pull out something that happened when he was 46, right?
Right.
And he dug that. And then he's like, so how many, you know, let's go. And he's like, how many questions do you have? And it was the proverbial, like, how much time you got? So we talked for hours. Okay. And I kept a running list next to on my desk. I called them Lanny cues. Just, you know, real little things would come up in the ICW days or what, even big moments like, you know, the snake bite and things like that. Just questions that maybe only he would know. And he responded a few of those. And then unfortunately, you know, and then I was about three quarters way through writing the book, maybe a little less. And I got the text from a mutual friend that he passed away. And it was really sad. I dedicated the book to him. It would not have happened without him. It bums me out that he doesn't get to read it, because I think this was, as the torchbearer to the legacy, I think he really would have appreciated this.
The funny thing about both the brothers is that the way they talked on screen is the way they talked in real life.
It's very
like
true.
Lanny would talk like this and would ask you questions, and Randy would talk like this, and this is what's going on. It's like, it's not a gimmick. Like, they didn't slip out of you. Like, hey man, what's going on? It was like they, those voices were real.
Yeah, I thought I would, when I was talking to him, it felt like I was being interviewed on his radio show booming stentorian voice.
Yeah.
And there was 50 people in a live audience, but it was me actually asking him questions, and he was like walking along the beach at Ecuador while I was like in my office, you know?
The thing that was cool about Randy too, and once again, going back to this kind of relationship that they had, is wherever Randy went, he always took care of Lanny, like his little brother. But Lanny, like Lanny is the genius in WWF. I mean, he wrestled Hulk Hogan on Saturday Night's Main Event. Like, he embraced that character and did a great job with it. And then, of course, when Randy came to WCW, Lanny was employed there as well. And I only saw him once in the 2 years that he was employed there. Yeah. But it was like, you know, like Randy was, no, take care of my little brother and give him 150 grand a year, whatever it is.
Yep.
He's here to work if you want him to. And you know, you never really saw him. But that was kind of Randy's creed, was that he wanted Lanny to always be kind of with him and taken care of as well.
Yeah, he felt like, you know, from all the even people I interviewed early on, from his neighbors growing up in Downers Grove, he was very much like the my brother's keeper type of guy. So, you know, he lived the dream for both of them. They both originally wanted to be baseball players. Angelo Poffo, who became a pretty well-known wrestler in the 50s and 60s, actually played baseball at DePaul, was a pretty good player, ended up getting hurt. But that was, you know, that was their sport. That was kind of the family's hobby sport, was following baseball. Both Lanny and Randy were very good little league players and moving up, you know. And as Lanny would say, you know, Randy's dream of playing baseball was a plan. Mine was just a dream, right? So Randy was an incredible, incredible athlete growing up, which is really some of the most fun parts of writing this book, was realizing that every single person you talk to from this little league all the way up to middle school, high school, they would have bet their life savings he was going to be a Major League Baseball player. I mean, he was that good.
So his early days playing baseball, so you were saying like that was kind of his mission when he was a kid, was to be a pro baseball player?
Up until 22, if you or I had talked to him or anyone on the street had talked to him, his dad wrestled, but it was not at all, it wasn't his goal. He didn't want to do it. He wanted to be a Hall of Fame baseball player. He wanted to be Johnny Bench. He wanted to be Pete Rose. These are some of the guys he looked up to. This is a kid, Chris, he walked around high school with his backpack and a baseball bat bag. So he had his favorite bat with him up and down the hallway wherever he went. And he brought with him a weighted baseball. So it's like a ball that weighs about twice as much as a regular baseball and is a little bit bigger. And I talked to classmates of his. They said he would sit in the back of class not to goof off or pass notes to chicks or anything like that. It was to do tricep kickbacks and squeeze the ball and toss it up to strengthen his forearm.
Wow.
I mean, that's the kind of obsession he had. He made his dad and some neighborhood dads build a batting cage on the side of their house with chicken wire and plywood. They put lights so he could play, because they lived in Chicago. So they were heating lights so he could play all throughout the year in the sunlit place while it was snowing and freezing outside. Neighbors could hear him playing at midnight, 1 a.m. out there, teaching himself to hit lefty because he was a righty. I mean, this was a man obsessed at every level with baseball.
And he even made it to like the minor league level, right?
Yeah, that was one of the biggest moments to talk to Lanny about for that stage of his life. It's crazy. So everyone who knew him was like, yes, Randy Poffo going to be a baseball player. And then he goes into draft and does not get drafted, which was like, not only like, oh, a negative thing from a storytelling standpoint, but it was a dream shatterer for him. They just couldn't understand how it didn't happen. So his father, being, you know, Angelo Poffo, tough guy, we don't take no, nothing bad happens, we overcome everything, drives him all the way to a tryout in St. Louis. There's 300 other minor league players trying out. They sign one guy, Randy Poffo.
Wow.
Because baseball scouts back then had all these weird intuition things and all that. They hear the sound of the ball off his bat. It sounds different than all the other players.
Hmm.
So yeah, he makes it into the minors. He makes almost no money. It's $400 a month back then. But he's able to survive, you know, he's a really smart guy. He's cleaning out the players in poker. So he's making all the money back. That Landy's comment was like, he didn't have the signing bonus, but he got their money anyway because he beat him in poker every night. And he was just on a mission to do that. And he came real close. He made it to AA and then had some, you know, good seasons. Then he hurt his shoulder. And this is probably the craziest story ever that you would appreciate as an athlete is. So he hurts his right shoulder as a catcher. And for most guys, your career is done. You know, you're in minor league baseball. You're hanging on by a thread. You can't throw, so you're out. So Randy goes home. and is like, this is not going to stop me. I have two arms. Screw it. I'm going to learn to throw lefty.
Wow.
So he goes and throws 1,500 balls a day against a grocery store next to it down his house in Sarasota.
Wow.
Every day, like 200,000 balls a month. He says, I found all these newspaper quotes from him back in the day because it was a pretty incredible feat. He said the next morning he woke up, he brushed his teeth lefty, combed his hair lefty, played cards lefty, opened the doors lefty, everything he could possibly do lefty, and taught himself to throw like a passable 70-mile-an-hour baseball lefty.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I took my son out after that research, who's 11, and I'm like, let's just throw left. Like, I'm just going to throw some lefty. And, you know, it's that chicken arm.
Oh, yeah.
I look like I never picked up a ball in my life. So anyone who's ever done that can understand how difficult it was.
So what kind of was the end of his pro baseball career, and what led him into pro wrestling?
Yeah, he like all baseball, you know, minor league players' dreams who die, they just get the cut slip. And he hung on and hung on. And I talked to, you know, his teammates, talked to some of the coaches, and he just, you know, they said if there was a Major League Baseball of heart and hustle and almost there, he would have been in it. He was just, you know, he could hit, but not hit well enough. He could hit for power, but just not enough power. He was fast, but not fast enough. He just didn't have all those intangibles to make it. And he got his cut slip. He ended up destroying the locker room as someone who eventually becomes Randy Savage would be. He, you know, did the throw the water coolers everywhere, tore down the lockers, and left in a tirade. Amazingly, he had one of his friends from high school had also played minor league baseball. I went to his place. They talked till 4 a.m. What are we going to do? You know, it's over. Like, it was clearly over. He had already had 3 or 4 chances where he'd been cut. And so he drives all the way home to Downers Grove in his beat up car. And this is like out of a movie. He gets out, takes his bat, shatters all of his bats against a tree at night when he finally gets home, breaks the bats, walks inside, says, I'm done with baseball, wakes up the next morning, I'm going to be a wrestler.
Wow. And once again, this is a guy whose dad is a very successful territory wrestler.
Yeah.
You know, and back then, that's all there was territories. This is pre-WWF expansion. And what I never knew as a kid, I remember the first time I saw Randy Savage was like, you know, I think he was doing something with Corporal Kirshner at a water park and Saturday Night's Main Event and pushing him off the water slide or some nonsense like that. But he'd already been in the business for, you know, over 10 years.
Yeah.
And what I was just looking at, he was already in his early 30s by the time he got to WWE, which you'd seem to be kind of late in development, but he'd already been doing this for over 10 years.
The thing that I appreciated the most is this is really a story of transformation and perseverance. You know, I've worked out my whole life. You have too. He built his life and body around baseball. So he's 22. You remember what you look like at 22? I do.
Yep.
He's about 6'1". He's listed as both throughout his career, even though he walked on his tippy toes and, you know, tried to look as big as possible. But he was not a giant. He wasn't a Hulk Hogan or, you know, a giant guy. But he was 185. So he knows in his mind, if he's going to do something, he wants to be, you know, the greatest that could ever be. He wants to be a, you know, Hall of Fame level, icon level. He knows if he's ever going to get to where he wants to go, he can't be 185, 190 pound wrestler. His brother, who was younger, was already, you know, was a couple inches taller, but also he was already 240. He'd been wrestling with his dad for a while. He's a big guy. And so he went on this incredible weight gaining quest, you know, reading Joe Weider, Muscle Builder Power, and reading all the early Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, workouts that were coming out there. And so he's eating, you know, steak, eggs, protein shake, repeat over and over and over again. And he manages to put on 10 pounds and then another 10 pounds. And pretty soon, you know, he gets up to that 220, 230 spot, which is important to your comment, because while he was trying to make his bones as a wrestler and get to WWE, he had time in the territory to build his body and then obviously build the personality that we saw. But in the beginning, you know, he was just a string bean named Randy Poffo trying to wrestle.
How far do you dive into his indie career? Because Angelo Poffo owned his own territory,
right,
in like the Indiana region or whatever it may be, something like that.
Yeah.
Continental Wrestling or no, it's ICW.
Yeah.
Right. So kind of how far do you go into that in the book? Because he's got such a huge career. And unless your book's 1,000 pages, you kind of have to be diligent.
Yeah, it's 300 pages. And I go as deep into it as is fascinating, right? So I'm not going to every little show, going from like Paducah to Lexington to this and this and this. But I hit the big points that matter. And the biggest point that matters for that is when Randy wanted to get into wrestling, Angelo sends him up to the original Sheik.
Oh, wow.
And he, you know, he didn't want him just to learn from just him. He wanted him to learn from all these other guys. And he had these guys like Harley Race and all these guys who'd been around for a while who were advising him on how to do it. And then they didn't originally have their own promotion. What happened was Angelo didn't like the booking for Lanny. He didn't like the booking for Randy. And what happened, he just dawned on him one day is, I have these two thoroughbreds in my family. He was still in great shape and could wrestle and still perform. And so he decided with these two guys, I can start, you know, I can have a title battle. I can start my own promotion. Oh. And that's when they started the ICW. And really, that's some of the most fascinating stuff in the book, starting a promotion. The tryouts alone were ridiculous. It was like military style, Navy SEAL style. Who's going to throw up? Who's going to pass out? Who's going to make it? They just had open tryouts at a gym and ex-wrestlers showed up, farmers showed up. And they ended up building their stable that way. And it wasn't until, you know, they ended up basically losing the battle of attendance and of viewership with Jerry Lawler's promotion that Macho, you know, made the next leap to the larger territory, which is, you know, going into Lawler and Jarrett's place.
In Memphis.
Yeah, Memphis.
Well, yeah, because I know too that like Lanny and Randy teamed there. I think they actually had a feud with the Rock and Roll Express when the Rock and Roll Express first started. So they were doing the territory rounds back then, which, like I said, every wrestler did, including Hulk Hogan, who was doing it with Vince Sr. and with Vern Gagne. So kind of what leads to Randy going to Vince?
It's a hard life, that early 70s wrestler. I talked to Rip Rogers, I talked to Bill Martin and George Weingroff and all these names who people who back then knew know who they are. I didn't know who they were until I started doing the book. Right. But these guys were on the road 5-6 days a week. They did these car loops where it was like, two shows a night, sleeping in the car, getting to the next show, morning, you know, TV spot, afternoon, radio spot, appearance at a grocery store, two shows, you know, for $50, right? I mean, they used to drive and Randy was like, they were all into, you know, exercise, but they had no money and they didn't want to stop. So they would stop and send somebody into the grocery store to get like a loaf of bread and like 4 pounds of turkey or whatever meat was on sale from yesterday. Angelo, who was a well-known penny pincher, would ask him to get meat from like, get the one they're about to throw out half off, right? Like just get the protein and they would just keep driving. And so ultimately they did a really good job of drawing attention. So they would intentionally get thrown out of Jerry Lawler's shows. They would intentionally, you know, have the cops called on them just to basically be that outlaw promotion.
Right.
But eventually they were banned from Rupp Arena, which in that area was the biggest place to be. It was the Golden Goose. And once you can't perform there, you can't have
it. Still is. It's still there.
Yeah. It's still there. Kentucky plays there. Elvis performed there. All these people perform there. And you can't make a living as an entertainer, especially a local entertainer, if you can't sell that place out every couple of months.
Without being in there, right?
Yeah. So after that happened, he held hat in hand to Lawler. They realized that like they built this angle for a year and a half without ever planning it. And they needed a way to actually monetize it and capitalize on it. So he and Lawler start an actual Let Loser Leaves Town and all the famous stuff that happened then. And he got noticed, you know, Vince was looking for new guys and he had just called up Jimmy, Mouth of South, Jimmy Hart. And he's like, don't you from there? Don't you know him? Even though they were like bitter enemies in the local territory. Jimmy Hart famously drove down and convinced Macho to come up. But the famous story that even Landy confirmed is like Macho thought it was like a work. He was sure that Jimmy was trying to get him to say something that he was like taped and he was going to go back to Lawler and someone was filming it. So like he patted down Jimmy Hart in the streets. And this is even the crazier story, just to give people an idea of how far Macho rose. During this time, he's making no money. So because he's a heel and a bad guy back then, you couldn't ever break character. Like couldn't go on Instagram and be nice and go to kids. So he couldn't do signings or sell t-shirts or anything. So he was selling vitamins on the telephone.
Wow.
So like you could have called up in the 70s. He worked for Amway and he'd be like, you need vitamin C or CoQ10. You know, like what kind of immune booster do you need today? You know? And so Jimmy got a hold of him because he said he wanted to buy a ton of vitamins. And that was why Macho agreed to go, because he needed the money. And then he finally convinced him it was legit and went up to New York and met Vince.
Where did the Macho Man persona come from? Was that a Vince creation and kind of what was the idea behind that?
Oh yeah, no, that was all him and Lanny. So Randy was wrestling as Randy Poffo, like I'd mentioned, skinny guy. As he's putting on weight, you know, in baseball, especially minor league baseball back then, you're clean shaven, you have short hair, you're wearing, you know, basically jeans and a t-shirt. You're not allowed to be loud, really.
Right.
When Randy decides to go into wrestling, he does like the George Costanza, I'm going to do the opposite, right? He grows his hair super long. He grows a shaggy beard. The amount of different outfits he tried before he settled on a little bit of the animal patterns and all that are actually really absurd. I have a hit list of them. It's like he did like a Stallone, You know, he did a Harley Davidson thing for a while. At one point, he looked like a giant George Carlin wearing like the hat with the brown shirts. then he went with like a straw cowboy hat for a little bit, which thankfully didn't take. And then eventually he settled on the animal prints with the sleeves cut. But for the character, you know, he wrestled like a madman. He was a man on the like come up. He wanted to get places. So he had like a tenacity, like a ferocity in the ring, wrestled very savage-like. And it was not good for the promotion to have the top three people be Angelo Poffo, Lanny Poffo, and Randy Poffo. So there's no reason back then anybody would know their brothers. They look nothing alike. They act nothing alike. So they go to Randy Savage. And he wrestles as just Randy Savage, I think, for about just shy of a year-ish. And then he's coming up. He needs a persona. There was a guy, I'm sure you've heard of him. There was a wrestler when they did the, they went with their dad when they were kids into the Hawaii Terry, Peter Maivez area. And there was a local guy named Pompero Firpo who he used to do these promos. And I found a couple really old ones through not even YouTube, like Reddit wormholes.
Right, of course, yeah.
And it's like, you know, this Saturday night at the Maui Lowy, whatever, you know. Yeah. And at the end, he would go, oh, yeah, right? And so Lanny says they had all these conversations like that. Do something like that. The way he tells a story is Macho kind of disappeared into a bathroom every, you know, a few hours every day, looking in the mirror, trying different octaves and growls, and over time settled on the freak out. He used to do a freak out used to be his intro thing. Like when a promo would start or they would start on local TV, it was like freak out. And he'd start all the twitches and everything. And he wanted people to think he was savage, almost like Neanderthal. Mm. And that was the early part of that. And the Macho Man origins, there's like six of them. And I cover them all in the book. There's a few credible, a few not credible. The two that Macho told the most almost can't be true from a timeline perspective. He talks about how he got thrown out of a baseball game, which he did. And that the next day the reporters were calling him the Macho Man Randy, but that makes no sense because at the time he was a diehard. He was trying to make a baseball team that never appeared again in print. We all do the same thing. We tell a story, whatever version sounds better over time. That's the one we stick with. But some version of it is his mom mentioned it to him after around the time the YMCA song was coming out, that Macho Man was going to be a big hit. There was a story in Reader's Digest that she showed him. The timeline, again, doesn't really add up because there was no story in it before the song came out. But suffice to say, in a 9-month span, the mini Macho Man was implanted in his head and it fit and he used it.
It's funny because I remember, like, once again, getting into WWF right when Saturday Night's Main Event started. I was a huge Savage fan and a huge Steamboat fan.
Yeah.
And the Ricky Steamboat t-shirt that they sold at the arena was really lame. So I bought the Violet Macho Man shirt. Right. Yeah, but I remember that. I was always nervous to wear it because I thought people would think that I was calling myself a Macho Man.
Oh, that's funny.
Like, you know, if I wear this in school, people are going to say, oh, you're some Macho Man. Like, no, it's wrestling.
Yeah, I know. That was the thing. You know, what's funny is, so before he got to that part of doing it, through the late 70s, right up until the early 80s, before he went to New York, he used to just make his own t-shirts. I have a list of about 30 of them in the book, like Better Than the best there ever was, the Macho Man,
right.
America Wants Macho, just whatever phrases came to his head, he would just wear all the time. And you remember like that old 80s like felt font, you know, that you could just stick the letters on the shirt. It was it was like he just went to like a mall, a mini mall side printing press and was like, today I want you to write, you know, Macho is King and just put it on there, you know? So he wanted a brand, you know, in the beginning when the newspaper articles and the promotions came out, the Macho Man thing didn't stick right away. Like, there's some goofy old headlines where he's like Mr. Macho Savage, Randy, the Mr. Macho Man, and then Macho Savage. Like, they just kind of mangled it for a while. And he apparently was like, you know, Randy, he would call like the newspaper and be like, it's not Mr. Macho, you know, it's the Macho Man, you know.
So let's talk about the relationship with Elizabeth. Such a one of the most classic, you know, pairings in pro wrestling history. And I remember when they brought Randy in at first to the WWE, there was kind of one of those things where who's going to be his manager? And they had all of the guys that were managing at the time. And he comes in with this, to this day, one of the prettiest girls in wrestling history, especially when you grew up in that era. It's like everyone was obsessed with Elizabeth and thought she was the greatest ever.
Yeah.
Well, how did that all come about?
It's the coolest story maybe like in the whole book, because we grew up, and you and I think are around the same age, like, she just was gorgeous and was always there. And so we didn't know anything. You know, I believe, right. Like I said, the match made in heaven, all that stuff. I was at the exact age where I thought they were getting married on TV and it was amazing.
Yeah.
When he loved her, he's always loved her. You know, the Gorilla Monsoon call, like, I was like, oh my God, this is really, they're getting back together. This is incredible. But they met like any meathead dude would meet a chick. She was working behind the desk at his gym. Yeah, she was the desk girl at his gym, right? Like, you know, all I have to say is, how would a meathead guy meet a pretty girl? It's like, she's either a trainer or works at the gym he goes to.
Yeah, so
one morning, you know, like every other morning, he's walking in growling, you know, he had bloodshot eyes because, dude, he used to have a guy, and you could appreciate this from performing. They would perform, you know, 4 or 5 hours away somewhere, get done at 10, 10:30 at night. And he was so obsessive compulsive about the gym he liked to work at in Lexington. He used to pay one of the newbie rookie guys to drive overnight so he wouldn't miss a 7 a.m. session in the gym.
Oh my gosh.
So he would sleep on the way down. They would get workout at 7 in the morning after being in the car all night, you know, a crappy little whatever. He'd work out. Then they would spend 4 more hours catching up with the rest of the team, you know, the rest of the crew back on to perform. And he did this every night. It wasn't like, oh, I just want to do it Wednesday because it's leg day and they have a good squat machine. This is a nightly thing. He would sleep in the car so he could work out at his gym.
Wow.
Anyway, at this gym in Lexington, he walks in one day and there's this beautiful brunette. The line that he always said was, you know, it was love at first sight, of course, because when she looked at me, what's not to love, right? And she'd been hit on before. You can read all these guys. And Lanny said it was like, you know, no one pays attention to who's behind the desk. It's like, you know, they say, have a good workout. And you, like an idiot, say, you too. And then you're like, oh, I mean, you know, have a good workout.
Right.
But they got together and they were quickly involved. And what I did not know, and I think most people don't, is that, like, so she had a communications background. And so he put her to work at the ICW. They put her, like, in the editing bay.
Oh, wow.
There's old footage of her announcing Lanny and Randy's matches. Like, they used to have a studio show where they would have her open, or they would, now we're cutting to, you know, Liz, and she would, now we're live at, you know, and it would be pre-taped and all set up time-wise. When she, when Macho got the call in New York, they'd already actually gotten married for real.
Hmm.
And it was a very small ceremony, like at her parents' house. And Lanny wasn't even there. He had a show and they didn't want Lanny. You know, they were in such a shoestring budget. They couldn't miss this stuff.
Yeah.
And they wanted to bring in a couple other women to be his valet. They did the whole thing of, like, he was the number one draft pick in wrestling. It was Bobby Heenan or Mr. Fuji or who, you know, for Classy Freddie Blassie, who was going to sign him? And then out walks, you know, famously from the yellow door in the arena, Elizabeth. You know, they're gushing at how beautiful she is. And then it goes from there.
Well, I mean, there's so much to talk about, but obviously you can't get into every detail. But one of the greatest matches of all time that I talked with at length with Ricky Steamboat.
Yeah.
Of course, is WrestleMania 3, Savage versus Steamboat. You mentioned the famous angle with the bell, and Ricky couldn't talk, and he had a speech that all.
Yeah.
But I mean, did you get any extra information about that, and do you know some of the stories behind that match?
Oh yeah, I mean, what they did, it was so I got in touch with Ricky as well, and he gave me a cool tour of his office, the
oh nice,
the Dragon's Lair, video wise. I didn't fly to where he lived.
Yeah,
the beauty of that match, and I lay it out in the book, is that I, and you would appreciate it, is that so many of these matches, they weren't done like this. They knew what it meant. And you know, the older generation of wrestlers, you know, Georgie Animal Steel, they really bristled at how much he wanted to prepare. Even Tito Santana, who I talked to, was like, I didn't mind it because I knew it was for quality, but it was a lot. It was enough.
Basically, what you're saying is he was putting together the match the way that guys put together the match now.
Yeah.
Beginning to end,
yep.
Every spot and move and false finish predetermined. Whereas back then, guys would just call stuff in the ring with what they felt. Yeah.
They learned, you know, in Georgie Handel Steele's, like, you know, we learned over beers in the car, like, here's what you do when we get there, and here's how it works, and here's how, hey, we're going to finish this way. All right, good luck, let's go.
Yeah.
And it was very different. So that one, they famously had 160 or whatever, you know, steps they were going to have.
Pages. He wrote every page down.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Ricky told you the story where he would call him and say, give me 85 through 70, through 112. Yep. And he'd have to give those spots there.
And they knew it. And, you know, the beauty of that match is that Randy, especially when they brought in that weird Georgie Animal Steel angle, which they weren't sure was going to work or why, but they had that simpleton angle where, like, he wanted to protect Elizabeth, but then you were like, no, don't do that, because then Randy's going to turn on you. Like, there was levels upon levels of a build.
Yeah.
And the beauty of it was, when you look at it now, it's obviously listed as the greatest or one of the greatest of all time and pivotal match in all of WrestleMania and wrestling history. But it's amazing that his most famous match was a loss, actually. And a couple times he was willing to do that, because the thing that he learned early in those ICW days and moving forward was the audience is first.
Yeah.
If the loss is the best thing that could happen for the audience, then he was down with that. And he game planned matches to make them think he was going to win so perfectly. He was so meticulous and methodical. I mean, he was a cerebral guy. People don't know. He was honor society in high school. He played chess. He was an excellent chess player, poker player. He was a well-read guy. So when it came to the creative side, he was second to none.
Let's talk about the other, well, there's many famous angles, but let's talk about the Mega Powers and his friendship, love-hate relationship, shall we say, with Hulk Hogan.
The thing that I learned when I researched that was the amount of chess pieces that had to happen so that he could win the title without pinning Hogan so that they could then be on the same side. It's really out of control when you think about they're planning this in the room early. You know, they've got Ted DiBiase, they've got Andre the Giant, they've got Hulk, they've got all these other pieces. They got the Honky Tonk Man. They have all these pieces. They have Intercontinental Champion. Then they got Honky Tonk saying he's the best Intercontinental Champion, which has nothing to do with the heavyweight title, but he has to say that to start the feud so that Hulk can run out and save him. And really, to your point earlier, the key was Elizabeth. We all believed in their relationship so much,
right,
that she would run out and get Hulk to save him and that he would then be the catalyst to helping him get the title. But what's interesting with all of our hindsight and perspective, it's almost like Hulk was really overshadowing the moment a little bit. I mean,
of course,
this Macho has wanted to be the title, the championship since the minute he baseball was over. So for him, like you said, he was already 32 or whatever. So 12 years, 13 years. And he has his, you know, his moment of glory, you know, and Hogan's in there watching it now. You're like, wait, Hulk, get out of the ring. Like, you know, and I know they said that he needed a little of the Hulk magic to the, but I don't think he needed the rub back then at all. I think he was big enough and it was a big enough moment, but when you watch it now, you can have a little bit of second guessing of like, wait a minute. And then, you know, Hogan was on the cover of the WWE magazine after Macho won. And the, you know, Macho would be on the cover and then it'd be like Macho on the cover. And I bought all these old magazines, so I have them all. And it's like Macho's on the cover. And then there's a 9-page spread on Hulk Hogan. And then like a 1-page thing on Macho. I am sure I didn't believe a lot of the stuff about the jealousy in terms of professionally. And then when I saw all this stuff, because I was a kid, but now I'm an adult and I can process it. Man, it had to piss him off, dude. Like, he finally got where he wanted to go, and he could not get an inch of space between him and Hogan.
Well, it's interesting, too, because they did the angle so well. And I remember it like yesterday when you used to have to go see Closed Circuit.
Yes.
They didn't have paper. It was Closed Circuit. You'd have to go to an arena and watch it on a big television screen, essentially. And they played it so well with Elizabeth getting knocked down and Hogan carries her out. And then Hogan lifts her up. And he's got his hand on her ass. And it's like, and Randy, too, as I'm sure you was insanely jealous for real.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole story there with that side of him. But they played it so well. But I still remember going to WrestleMania 4 for the tournament, for the world title.
Yeah.
And when Hulk and Andre went out with the double countout, I couldn't fucking believe it. Like, Hogan's not going to win.
Yeah.
So when Randy won, I didn't buy it because Hogan's the champ. Randy's not the champ, but they tried to play that off that Randy had it, but they didn't do it in a way, like you said, he didn't beat Hulk. So to me, Hulk was still the uncrowned world champion. And Savage was just a guy that had it.
It was like they vacated the belt. They did vacate the belt.
They did.
But it was like in boxing where they just vacate the belt and it's like, he never disappeared. Then they immediately went into the Mega Powers and all these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the craziest parts about that is I think they left like a year of cool booking on the table with Macho Champion. Like, I never thought of it that way. And I know they'd set up everything earlier than that. Like, here's how it's going to go. And they were never going to let Hulk disappear or whatever. And Randy was a great champ for that year. Everybody says so. All the wrestlers I talked to said he was great. They never played the angle, which nowadays they would have done a million times, I think, and you could speak better to it, where Hulk is all of a sudden a little bit like, is this guy now 1A? Like, they never did the reverse side of like Macho in the ring getting all the applause and maybe Hogan giving that little bit of a doing this kind of thing, but it's not as popping like it used to. You know what
I mean? But John, they couldn't because Hogan was the consummate babyface.
Yes.
And Vince didn't want to do anything to mess with that image. Like, 4 years, Hulk was the champ, right? Yeah. So when Randy wins it, like you mentioned, I think Hulk's going off to make movies and stuff.
Yep.
He was just a placeholder, even though he really wasn't. But in Vince's mind, he was.
Yeah.
So like you said, when they do the Mega Powers, well, of course they're going to explode where Randy goes heel again because he couldn't be the top babyface as long as Hogan was in that company.
That had to have eaten him up because in any other time period, he gets his moment. Maybe he wins it 3 or 4 times or whatever it is and has other rivalries throughout.
Yeah.
And he did, you know, Ric Flair and Warrior and all that. But we never got the pin, like you just said, that we wanted.
Yeah.
That, you know, Lanny will never say a cross thing about Hulk Hogan because he was responsible for those 2 or 3 biggest weeks of his life when they had that little story arc. You know, he said, he's like, we talked, I asked the same question.
The same to me.
Deep down, whatever. And he's like, I will never say a crossword. He's responsible for the highlight of my career, and I will always owe him for that. So you're not going to get anything from me on that. So it's really just, you know, speculation. And some of the guys who wrestled with him early on, who knew him later,
yeah,
you know, were like, look, Hogan was the golden goose. They weren't going to have anything happen to him. Well, but
and you can say what you want, Hogan this, Hogan that, but the final decision is Vince's.
Yes.
So, and that also leads to the next thing where Vince basically, it's so funny how it's changed. You know, I'm 53 and still, you know, working at the top of my career in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Randy at like 40, whatever it was deemed too old.
Yeah.
And Vince cut him. Did you go into that in the book and how that made Randy feel?
Yeah. It shattered him. You know, he took the time off to go in the booth. You know, mentally, we have to remember what happened in his personal life was the diametrical opposite of what was happening in his professional life. And it messed with his head tremendously. You know, he's doing the match made in heaven at SummerSlam weeks after his actual marriage is falling apart and they're going to.
So Elizabeth and Macho Man are basically getting divorced.
They're done and having a big fallout. They've decided it's over. You know, there were some rumors they were going to take time off and maybe try to rekindle and maybe start a family or whatever.
But on screen, what's going on at the time?
Right. So he's in the ring giving millions of people around the world what they want. Ooh, yeah, you know, I do all that stuff. But really, in real life, they're divorced. Like, they're separated. Wow. Then the public issue comes out in the magazine next that he's confirming the divorce like 2 months after this happened on pay-per-view. And he needs time. I mean, anybody would. And so he takes a little time and then he goes in the booth and he thought it was just something different for a little bit. Let everything change and go through. And unfortunately, Vince was done. One of my favorite things I did talk to Lanny, I don't know if you got into it with him, was Macho, because of these guys, their whole lives were performing at night. They didn't sleep. You know, Macho didn't sleep. He'd call you at 2 a.m, 3 a.m. And I guess he gave Lanny a call one morning at 3:00 and was like, I know how I want to finish my career. And he had this idea where he was going to toast to Shawn Michaels about, you know, Shawn was the next generation. And right before they toasted, he was going to shatter the champagne bottle on his head and tell him he wasn't taking his spot. And then they were going to start a feud that would have been at least 2 or 3 pay-per-views. And that eventually he would hopefully have a match on par with Steamboat, lose, and then, then figure out go in the sunset or do movies or whatever.
Wow.
And so Lanny's like, I was researching like shattering champagne glasses. Like, we were going to do this. And they pitched it to Vince, assuming he was going to, you know, because they had a very good relationship, going to say yes. And he said what you said. He's like, no, I mean, we're going with, you know, youth movement was the term.
Yeah.
And that was it. And you know. He had a grudge list very, very long, and Vince was at the top from that point on.
Was there ever anything to the rumors of Randy and Stephanie? And did you talk about that in the book at all?
I looked so hard I come journalism background. I did not want to just say things that people said, especially wrestlers, as you know.
Because the rumor was there was a falling out between Vince and Randy because Randy somehow had a relationship with Stephanie. Yeah.
There is nothing on the record. It's one of those things. It's like the story about, you know, did he lock Liz in rooms when they went on things or whatever? And I talked to Hacksaw and Paul Roma and, you know, Rip Rogers, all these guys who knew him all then. What I can say is that because of his personality, it's possible. Like, you wouldn't not believe it.
So intense.
Yeah, he was so intense and he cared for her. And a lot of these locker rooms were, you know, there was no woman's locker room. There was very few female wrestlers. So he wanted to protect her from that storyline. From the Stephanie one, there's no one on record anywhere ever saying that it actually happened. It's just, he's the Macho Man. And so you're kind of like, maybe there's like a 5% chance that is the real reason. But to me, having spent 2 years in this guy's life, telling him he's too old and you have to leave is enough to cause this kind of feud for this guy. Right, he was extremely, extremely vain. He looked after his body almost like it was a machine, his tan, his beard, his hair. He covered, you know, he did everything he could to cover his receding hairline, and his height bothered him. He wanted to be taller. So he learned to walk on his tippy toes and wore these huge heels in his boots. So he looked taller. A lot of the guys were like, you know, you'd see him backstage changing and talking to him. And it was almost like, you know, where did Randy go? You know, Paul Roma has a great line. He's like, I came from a bodybuilding, like football background. And here's this like little guy walking around with like, he has bowling balls under his arms with his chest out. You know, he said, what is he doing? And they were like, that's Macho. Like, that's just how he is. it's his whole thing. And he's like, why doesn't he just get bigger? You know, he's like, he's putting on the whole act with that stuff, you know?
But it's crazy though. Like you said, like the size was so important back in that time frame. And Randy was a big guy. Like when I started in WCW 96, I had hardly any interactions with him, which is such a shame. One of my biggest regrets was I never got to have a match with Randy Savage. Although after when I saw him, when I left to go to WWE, I saw him in Tampa and he's like, I wish we would have had a match together. I'm like, oh, dude, man. You could have requested it at any time.
Anytime you want.
You're Randy Savage. You could have booked it yesterday.
Yeah.
But he was a big guy, but he wasn't super tall. Maybe a little bit taller than me, and I'm about 5'11". So I think he might have been around 6', which you said. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, Hogan was 6'6", 6'5", whatever he was. So even though he wasn't tall, he was still big, and you never really noticed the difference. But I can see how that would get into his space, especially when he could never get higher than Hogan on the card.
Yeah, and you know, the match, looking back, and if you've ever gone down that YouTube of just the matches, so he does manage to take up the same space as Hogan throughout their promos. You never think about it. And even though Hulk is legit 6'6", 6'7", back in his heyday.
Yeah.
But the match where he actually looks small is the Ultimate Warrior match at WrestleMania.
Mm.
If you, I don't know the last time you checked it out, probably not recently. I hadn't seen it in years until I was really researching the book and watching everything with my son. And it was like, he looks like a little kid because Warrior was a legit 6'3", 285.
Yeah, so massive.
Monster of a human being, a foot wider than Macho Man. And when he's doing the gorilla press and he's throwing him around the ring, he's really ragdolling. And it's the first time I think that you notice how much bigger, because it was a muscular guy. Obviously, Andre the Giant in the ring with Macho, he's much bigger, but he's not a ripped dude. When you're looking at someone like Warrior, it looks like he's throwing his little brother around the ring. And that's where I think the character, the sound of the character, and I think that's why even off screen, when I talk to people who are at book signings, or not book signings, like his rap album signings and people who went to things where he was, you know, selling stuff, so many of them said like, hey, he's a little smaller than I thought, a little smaller than I expected, because the character was
big,
you know?
It's such an insult when you're a wrestler, too. It's like Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse. I thought you'd be bigger. and a quick segue, that Ultimate Warrior match with Savage is probably Ultimate Warrior's best match. It's such a great match.
Oh, he made everyone look good.
How was it for him when Elizabeth passed away? Because I just looked it up. I didn't realize that she passed away in 2003.
Yeah.
He passed away in 2011. Did that affect him? Because in WCW, they obviously were split, and she was with Lex, and he had Gorgeous George with him. But I'm sure there was still some deep feelings there.
Yeah, he says kind of what we would almost all say about a past love or a past thing. He had gone on the record a few times after that about saying that they hadn't actually seen each other in a few years. But you know, he said he was very gracious. He was not like a jackass kind of person when it came to people and relationships and who he cared about. And Elizabeth was in his inner circle for a long time. He loved her. His quote was, you know, a piece of me, even though we haven't been together, you know, dies when she dies, is a piece of his heart is gone. They spent a lot of good years together, and you know, he felt for her family and her friends and all that kind of stuff. And at that stage of his life, it was one of those things where that almost helped close the door for him on that era. And it was a tough time. The Luger stuff was tough to watch, I think, for some, even though as always real life mixed with other things. But he had moved on to other things. And then later in his life, even remarried a woman who he dated when he was like 23 in his minor league days. So he was able to find peace and serenity after that.
Let's talk about the rap album. I mean, obviously that was a big newsworthy item. There was some real stiff words against Hulk. What do you think about all that? Because it is such a bizarre, like, what? He's rapping? Like, what the fuck is that? Like, it seems very strange.
Like I said, it's a story of reinvention. And he was into rap. He was always listening to rap music when he worked out towards that time of his career. And like every other relationship in his life, seemingly it happened at the gym. He was listening to rap at the gym. Someone heard him, you know, heard something and asked if he wanted to, you know, if he ever thought of rapping or being a guest on an album in Tampa. A producer, you know, met him at the gym and he went over and maybe he was going to be on a track, but Macho being Macho was like, you know, I'm not doing a track, I'm doing an album, right? Like, I'm not going to do a guest spot, I'm doing the whole thing.
Yeah.
And he threw himself into it, and he was always looking to reinvent. You know, he wanted to stay cool with the younger crowd. I heard an interview you did with Dice a while back. And he talked about how living the character, you become this kind of cartoon where, I remember Dice is like, I dress like this is how I dress. And like, they just become that. And I think Macho did all of that with the Randy Savage character and Macho Man character for so long that when something came along that interested him, like amazingly rap, he decided to go all in, and he's got the chain around his neck and he's doing what rappers are doing. Unfortunately, he was not a very good rapper.
His WCW time frame and kind of beyond, did he enjoy that time? I know there was a lot of issues when those WWE guys came to WCW about how there was a lot of disorganization and that sort of thing. Of course, Hogan is still there. They finally get to have their match, but
yeah, it
was a strange time for I would probably guess for him.
Yeah, he was beat up. He'd been doing this for a very long time. Unfortunately, his signature move was just about the worst thing you can do for your body, just continually landing on your hip and your elbow and your shoulder joint for year after year after year. And those early ICW years, those territory years, you know, they're landing on basically a wooden plank with like a quarter inch of foam
right
on top. And
terrible rings.
He wasn't comfortable. He wasn't physically comfortable. He liked the WCW rings were smaller. So he had mentioned a few times in interviews and that he could move faster and he looked faster. But he was not able physically to do the things he could do. He had a nice view with DDP, and that was, I think, one of the highlights of his time there for sure. You know, Father Time was what probably his biggest issue was. He was getting older. Wrestling changed. You know, he started the Attitude Era came in. Everybody's talking shit to each other, and he's going with the ponytail and the all black and yelling. And, you know, when for those of us who grew up at peak, Macho had so much fun, and he was such a joy with charisma. And even his promos that were mean were still fun. It all of a sudden became like this, I call it dark Macho, like this just angry, screaming guy who's now like 48 and doesn't look like he can actually, he needs help climbing over the rope, let alone getting to the top rope. I call it dark Macho period because from there, through the rap album, really until Spider-Man, he was sort of didn't understand that he had achieved what he wanted to. He was an icon, and I don't believe he really understood that till the very end of his life.
No, I agree with you. And it's interesting, too, because even, if you know, the whole Slim Jim thing, which was synonymous with Randy, it still is. Like, I don't know the other guys have done Slim Jims, but it's like, yeah, it doesn't fit. Like, for wrestlers, it's Slim Jim. That kind of almost made him a mainstream star because those commercials were everywhere.
It did make him a mainstream star. He was at NASCAR events, which was huge. He had, you know, they had Slim Jim car. He was at NFL games. So I found a really old newspaper article right after he got to be champion in WWF. And he was actually the face of Mountain Dew first.
Oh, wow.
Mountain Dew signed a contract with WWF for a promo called Slam of the Night. They were just going to pick the best slam of every telecast and call it the Slam of the Night, slamming a Mountain Dew. And they picked Macho to lead it as the face because he was obviously champion. So he did that for a year. And they had a belt that said Mountain Dew Slam of the Night. And then it kind of, you know, fizzled like a lot of things do. But there's an alternate universe where he's the face of Mountain Dew for like 20 years, you know? And then, and you know, thankfully, Sam Kinison passed on the Slim Jim thing and Warrior wasn't really good at it. And when they settled on Macho, it's really why he has some of the staying power he does today. It's why, like, my mom knows Macho still because the commercials are so ubiquitous and you couldn't take your eyes off him. And now, you know, he's got spots in commercials right now with, you know, still, LA Knight, right? all these guys. Yeah.
Did he ever get over his feud with Hogan?
I think he did. Yeah. So the last chapter of my book, I call it Serenity, because he seemed to have finally understood that there was no reason to be angry anymore. And that was something Lanny and I talked about. He'd run into Hogan. So when he traveled all those years, his parents, he was very close, like you'd mentioned very early on. They were older. He didn't get to take them to the doctor's appointments and do all the things that he wanted to do as a son. So when he finally gave everything up, and he used to have a cool condo on the beach in Tampa, sold that, moved to like way west. Like, I went to go drive to get to it. It's like one of those where it's like, do not drive down. Then there's another road that says road closed. And there's another thing. And then there's a house surrounded by woods, like in an acre of land with like German shepherds guarding it, like beware of dog. So it was that kind of house. I went up to it about a year ago. Obviously he's not there. But once he got secluded, he really came to peace with who he was. And so it seemed like he'd ran into Hogan. They'd had a quick little, you know, at least the bridges were not burned. Just kind of softened and did a commercial for WWE, let them shoot at his house for a video game. It's really sad. We were robbed of that great return, the great second act of obviously not wrestling, but just some of the anniversary of his matches. You know, if he just showed up at a ring, you know, even today, either with Hogan or with Ricky, the place, I mean, even the Rocks Pops right now, I think it would absolutely go crazy. So he did. And it looked like he had that with a lot of people, and he was finally understanding he was beloved and he didn't allow himself to feel that way for a very long time.
It's interesting. I was at Bryan Adams' funeral and I was talking to Brett, and I don't remember when Bryan passed away, but this guy came up to us and he was talking to us as if he knew us. And he was kind of like eavesdropping on the conversation to an extent. And I remember like thinking to myself, and Brett and I kind of gave each other a little bit of a Iggy to each other. Like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
And he was an older guy. This is in 2007 and a white beard, kind of a little bit stout. And it was, yeah. and he opened up his mouth and it was Randy.
That's incredible.
And I was like, holy smokes. Because the last time we had seen him was, like you mentioned, Spider-Man Randy, super jacked, still dark black. This was like the Randy who had accepted, okay, I'm getting older. And we had a great conversation, but I remember Brett went, Randy, is that you? Like,
yes.
Sold it huge. And I didn't sell it all. I was like, hey, Randy, as soon as he talked, of course, you know that voice. But I couldn't believe how different he looked at that time.
What a magical moment. Yeah, his physical transformation very much aligned with the mental transformation that he went of being at peace. He stopped going to tanning beds. He stopped dyeing his hair. He kind of trimmed up his beard from being shaggy. He stopped wearing clothes that were for a 25-year-old.
Right.
And towards the end of his life, I talked to people who were around him those last few months at the diner he went to. And, you know, the guy whose tree he hit, sadly, I took my daughter on my research road trip and we saw the tree that in Seminole County that's now like a de facto memorial to Randy. And the guy was home and he was a big Macho fan and he'd seen him around town and see him at Perkins having breakfast. And they all say he was just like, you know, because of the beard, he made a joke about Santa Claus, but like he was happy to take pictures. He was happy to do everything. He still every year was doing the Children's Hospital gig for George Steinbrenner and the Yankees and reading The Night Before Christmas. He was very much a part of the community, very approachable. And so, I'd like to believe that that exact attitude and that legacy would have carried nationally once the spotlight might have turned back on him.
Well, he's so beloved. And once again, one of the most imitatable wrestlers ever, maybe more so than Hogan. You know, everybody can go, oh, yeah, like everyone can do that to this day.
Yeah.
Quickly, he had a heart attack at the wheel while he was driving.
Yeah, it's really crazy. When you drive on the street, you actually understand what the scenario was. So just picture a two-lane highway, one going one way, one way the other, where there's like a couple of red lights every maybe quarter mile or so. So he leaves the diner with his wife. The whole morning, I guess he'd been complaining that he just short of breath. Things now that most of us would say, it sounds like a heart attack.
Yeah.
But he was the Macho Man. And when they left the diner, she had offered to drive. And again, he's the Macho Man. I'm driving. And so they're driving on the inside lane going this way. And picture two lanes coming the other way. And it's like a 4-foot median. It's not like there's any barrier or anything. And, you know, he was still pretty big. Like you said, he was stout, but he was probably still well over 220 or something like that.
Sure, sure, sure.
He falls forward, atherosclerosis, like heart attack, falls forward on the wheel, passes out, leans left because he falls left. And the car immediately swerves into oncoming traffic. And his wife reaches over him because his foot fell on the gas. So he's just gunning it across this thing. Apparently there was a bus, a motorcycle, all these things. This guy whose house I talked to was gardening right in front. She lunged over and ripped the wheel to the left and like managed to like punch his foot off of the gas. So the car slowed a little bit and they slammed into this tree. If they hadn't, they would have gone right through this guy's house. But when you look at it, even when I did the U-turn, I'm like waiting and waiting for like 4 minutes just to do the U-turn. Like he went into full traffic.
Just total lucky, right?
Yeah. She saved, even he said, he's like, I drive this road every day. I live here. She probably saved a couple lives or at least some serious injuries by doing that. But he was dead on the scene. He who knows why his heart gave out that way. But it's really crazy. I one of the research parts of the road trip was I took my daughter up. We visited all where he lived and all the things you do when you're writing a book like this and interview whoever happens to be around. Hey, I know he worked out here. I know he did this here. I did not expect to find the guy who lived at the house. And I did not expect that he was home the day it happened and that he went to the same church.
Jeez.
And that, he was playing pickleball like the day after or whatever it was. They had a pickleball court. It used to be a different court. The tree itself, 13 years later, you'll love this, Chris. You go there, you pull up. First thing you kind of see from afar is things like flailing off to the side. People are thumbtacking Slim Jim wrappers all over the tree. Still, this is 13 years later. There's purple tassel all over the place. When you get closer, you start seeing stickers of sunglasses all over the bark of the tree. And at the base of the tree, there was three old Macho Man, action figures.
That's so great.
It was a big moment for my daughter and all that stuff to like see how much he still meant. And it meant a lot to me to be there. So, and there's no official signage. You literally have to like Google Earth it and kind of figure out what the news reports say. And it was a real kind of detective mystery for us.
Last couple of questions for you. First off, what do you think Randy's legacy is, not just pro wrestling, but in pop culture?
I think he has arguably the most transitional like legacy from a wrestler from that era, even more almost so than Hogan. Memes are huge. The people who share memes and learn how these, like when I was doing the book, I'll use my son as an example. He was 9 when I started. He's into wrestling. He was into you. He's into all these guys. And he's watching Peacock. You can watch all the old matches. You know what I mean? But he first heard about him because when he got his, you know, iPad and started texting people, the, oh yeah, snap into it. He knew of him from a whole other angle.
Right.
Like he didn't even know he was a wrestler until obviously I'm doing what I'm doing. And I shared with him who he was. And he's now watched every match probably of his life and old Piper's Pits and everything. But he crossed over like no other wrestler, maybe, you know, The Rock or ways like his movies and stuff like that. And what's the most amazing about him is he didn't do movies. He didn't do any of the things beyond Slim Jim. He didn't try to be in a bunch of B movies like Hogan. He didn't try action movies, you know, early on like Cena or some of these guys. He was just a wrestler. He did voiceover work. And it's funny, there's a generation of people who know him from the voice in Bolt, all these other weird things from cartoon voices and video game voices and stuff like that. But I think his legacy still is as the most charismatic, unique, transcendent wrestler of maybe all time. And truly, and again, you would know more for sure, but athletic. He was a true blue athlete. He was one of, you know, we had a lot of football players who have come in, and a lot of guys obviously have to be athletic to do what they do, but he was a pro athlete level baseball, which is a different level eye-hand coordination wise. You know, Tito Santana played football, and Hacksaw played football, and DiBiase played football. He was like an agile, like a Spider-Man type out there. And that was a really unique thing to see.
Last question for you. What's your favorite? Is there a favorite story in the book that we haven't discussed? Some kind of anecdote that someone told or a moment that Randy had?
Oh, there's so many. One of my favorite interviews in the book is I tracked down Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff's son.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine being eight, your dad's Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff with, you know, kissing the arm and all that. And your dad's doing his match. You're into wrestling like we all were. And the match ends and you're getting on a bus, a Greyhound tour bus. And Hogan's over there and Randy's over there. And Randy used to do the thing that, you know, what's on your shirt? Boop to this kid. And he says, you know, Randy was the only guy who would talk to me like a person. And for like the rest of his life, whenever he ran into him, he would always do that thing. And when I was asking like stuff that he would know or not know about him, that to me was just, you don't get too many kid perspectives. I mean, he was probably the only kid on the bus that was ever there.
Right.
The theme that ran through the book from the non-wrestling side was how great he was with kids, all kids, charities, philanthropies, and then wrestlers' kids. Paul Roma has a similar story about how he ran into him years later. He had kids who were like 6 and 8, and he did the full macho, and a high school guy ran into him at wrestling, who coached high school, and he did a pep talk before the season started. So it's nice when you do these kind of books and you spend a year and a half researching and the guy is actually like a good dude and did good things. But the Paul Orndorff, his son, that was a pretty cool story. We all do that little thing with kids.
Right.
The fact that Macho did it with, you know, Mr. Wonderful's son made me smile.
Well, it's the untamed, unbelievable life of Randy Savage. And John, it was a pleasure talking to you, man. I'm looking forward to reading this and remembering how great one of my all-time favorites was and still is.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a nostalgic ride for all of us who grew up in the Madness era. So I know you'll enjoy it.